Time for me to say goodbye, but till next week, happy reading. Bye for now.
And now it's time for Stages.
Stages.
All the world's a stage.
It's where we talk about,
all things
theatrical.
It's about theatre.
Theatre makers.
If it's performing on a stage, we've got it for you here on Stages.
It's about half an hour long.
Okay, let's get on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Stages. I'm Regina Botros and we are talking theatre. This evening we will be talking with Katie Pollock. She's a Sydney-based playwright. Her plays for theatre are Normal, The Becoming, The Handside Monologues, Age of Entitlement, Blue Italian, Kneel by Sea, on and on it goes. She's won awards in 2018, the Rodney Seaborn Playwrights Award, the Lysicrates Prize, the Town Hall Theatre of the USA Ingenious Grant. That sounds just absolutely wonderful. The Inscriptional Edward Albee Playwright Scholarship. Her works have been produced by the ABC. I have produced one of them for the ABC. She's also had works for Apocalypse Theatre, Casula Powerhouse, Merengong Theatre. Gee, so much to talk about with her. She is also currently works at Currency Press as an editor. So stick around. It'd be great to have a chat with her later on in the show. Trisha Stars will be joining us for a few things to catch around town. Yes, a little Nick Cave. He is playing tomorrow evening, Thursday the 23rd of July. It's a solo show recorded at London's Alexandra Palace, and it's called Idiot Prayer. The various sorrows, some begged, some borrowed, some stolen, some kept safe tomorrow. On an endless night, silver star spangled, the bells from the chapel went jingle. Well, you're listening to Stages, and on the line we have Katie Pollock. She's a Sydney-based playwright. She's an award winner. She's been nominated for 2 Orgies and was a finalist in 2 Silver Gull Awards and the Woodward Newman Drama Award of the USA. How exciting. She's an editor at Currency Press, and I came across her back in the early 2000s when one of her plays, Blue Italian, I sat in on a recording of the ABC and had it come across my desk also at 2SER. Welcome to Stages, Katie.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So we'll have a little dig into your playwriting practice and what you're working on now and how things are looking. But before we do, I want to get a sense of, you know, who you are and where you've come from. So what was it like growing up for you? What were your family like? Were they creative? Where were you from?
Well, yeah, so I was born in the UK and spent most of my early days in a little place called Bognor Regis on the south coast of England, which has been the butt of many jokes over the years. So there are two distinct parts of my growing up, because primary years were there in this little place where really nothing happened, and there was that sort of classic wandering the streets, be home for tea time kind of behaviour. And then when I was 11, my family moved to America. My dad got work there. And that second half of my growing up was then basically moving countries every year and a half and going to a different high school every year, and really very disruptive in that disruptive schooling, but also very disruptive socially because, yeah, as I say, we went to the US, and then a year and a half later, we moved to France, and then a year and a half after that, we moved back to the UK. Even in the time at the US, I went to 2 different schools there because of crossing over between years at school. So I went to 5 different high schools by the time I finished, which meant that the part of my growing up where you're really forming your personality was basically made up of people leaving people and finding new people, having to make new friends all of the time. And so it was very formative for me in an artistic sense, because really the only way I found to do that in a fast way was through theatre, through doing school theatre stuff. Because, you know, that thing when you're doing a show, you're an instant family. You know, if they're on stage, I mean, we were all on stage then, all kids doing the acting. If they're on stage or they're part of the team, then you're instantly okay. And for me, that was a huge and necessary escape from constantly being the new kid, which was awful, frankly. I mean, I don't blame my parents. You know, Dad had to do that for work. But, you know, there was a lot of bullying. And, I mean, you're always new kid in school with the wrong accent and the wrong clothes and all of that stuff. Yeah, doing theatre things was the thing that saved me, really, absolutely, 100%.
So did you perform as well then? You started as a performer more than a writer?
Yeah, acting. And, you know, were my parents creative? The answer is absolutely not. Yes, but also not, because they always looked at it as just this hobby thing that you do because you've got no friends. So it was certainly never anything that they ever encouraged as work. And until really very, very late, I'm going to say like last year, you know, essentially. Even though I say no, but yes. So when you drill down, I look at so my dad at one time used to play guitar. I mean, that's creative. He didn't care because, you know, it's just a hobby sort of thing. And my mum, extremely creative in terms of being a maker, and I often thought that she should have been a props maker in the theatre. She would have been absolutely brilliant at it. But again, it was just a sort of little thing kind of you do to, you know, fill up your time when you're not doing your proper job.
So what happened last year then that changed their minds?
Well, a couple of things, one really good and one really bad. Mm. The really good thing last year was that my play Normal was published by Currency Press, and so I was able to deliver them solid physical proof of my work, because they've never seen one of my plays because they're still in England. So it's, to them, it doesn't really exist, but here it was in published form and they couldn't really deny it. And then the other thing that happened, which was really bad, was that my brother passed away very suddenly. Mm. And he was an artist. He worked on classic cars. It's called pinstriping, doing those kind of crazy flames and designs and things. Yeah. And they never appreciated him as an artist either at all. In fact, they hardly knew what he did. And it was really only when he died and then hundreds of people came out in shock and mourning that they were forced to really wake up to that and go, so that was a thing then, you know, people actually appreciated this thing you do called art. So I think it was a bit of a revelation for them, for both of us.
Mm. I'm sorry about that. That's a bit sad.
It's a shame, isn't it? I really wish that all parents could see their kids, you know, earlier.
So you went and you used theatre as a way of accessing or, you know, getting to know people. When did it change and when did you go from, you know, using it as the tool or portal to thinking or becoming a writer or starting writing? Like, when did that sort of begin?
Yeah, I'd always done acting, so that was through school and uni. And when I left uni, I wanted to go and study acting, but of course there was no support from the parents for that, and I wasn't brave enough to just say, well, I'm doing it anyway. I had a break then. I was working in Thailand as a journalist, and I had a break from theatre completely at that point, other than occasionally writing about it. And it was when I arrived in Sydney, I was doing acting classes at the Acting Centre, and I never got through an audition at that point, which was probably a combination of A, being crap, and B, you know, I had a very English accent, and let's put it more on the A, being crap. So then I did the classic, I know I'll write a play, I'll be in it. And so I wrote a play and it, you know, it didn't work out with a part for me. So, but that was the point where I went, hey, this is better.
A lot of your plays have that very verbatim. Does that come from your journalist time in Thailand, would you say? Or?
Only those two Hansard Monologues plays. The rest don't really at all.
Like Neil by Sea sort of takes the story of something as a kind of a seed or...
Yes, yes. Okay, that's different. They're not... So that's not verbatim at all. Verbatim is only the Hansard Monologues plays, but absolutely I do read a lot of news and I definitely use news as an inspiration for sure.
Okay, so was that, do you think, through your journalism?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, doesn't everyone read the news? Maybe they don't.
But they don't all make plays out of it.
Well, it's just, there's so much out there. That's the thing. I mean, for a long time, I've had this habit of, well, of course, back when you used to read the news on actual paper, I would clip the things. Now I just save them, just saving stories that have something of some interest, and I don't really know why it's interesting. I just go, far out, that's curious, that's interesting, I don't know. And then I would just chuck them into a box. And every now and then when there's a gap, I finish something, I want a new thing, whatever, I will go to the box and sift through these pieces of paper. And sometimes occurs that there are sort of three or four things on the same theme or that somehow seem linked. And that's when I go, so I must have been interested in that for some reason. I wonder what it is. So it's really useful. I would encourage anybody to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So with this time and this traveling and going and then, you know, going to the Actors Center, were there like a turning point where you decided that this is what you wanted to do? And did you kind of have people that were instrumental in helping you along the way?
Look, I haven't had any sort of mentor as such. I think there was somebody much earlier, in fact, when I was at school. I would have been in about year 10, actually, because I went to it was called Sixth Form College there, so a separate school for HSC years. And that school, I was really horribly bullied. But my form teacher was the drama teacher, and he actually let me skip classes that were the worst classes and hang out in his form room and help with the younger kids with the drama classes. And I think that was probably a much more formative moment than I realised at the time, where it was kind of the moment where I went, I see that this is better than reality.
Right.
You know, reality was just too much, and that there was world that you could escape into. And so even though it took me a really long time to get back to finding that world again, I think that was really probably... And the other thing was that I'd only arrived at the school that year and I got the lead part in the play. And, of course, all the other girls hated my guts because they'd been working their way up through the little parts or whatever. And it was sort of moment where I went, oh, this is much better than, yeah, that you can imagine a different possibility. I suppose that's it. That you can step away from the real situation and imagine something new and completely different. And so even though I don't feel that I've had a sort of, you know, a champion or anything, there have always been people who have encouraged, and I mean, now I get that very much from my playwriting colleagues, you know, people who I've talked to, who we're all working alongside each other in this industry, and mostly they're all doing, you know, bigger and better things than me, but they're my friends, and you know, you sort of call them for a bit of a cheering up now and then.
Would you say that then there is a bit of a community of playwrights?
Oh, absolutely. I rely on it, yeah. And I think it's really crucial to have that understanding that even though it so often feels like we're in competition with each other because of the resources are so scarce and so few and far between, We're not really, because everybody has their own voice and their own subject matters and, you know, their own style. And I can't write the play that Susie Miller writes or the play that Lachlan Philpott writes or Vanessa Bates or anybody, and they can't write the play that I write. And I think it's much more important that we support each other than that we feel against each other. And I have found that over the years. I feel it's absolutely a really good community, and generally playwrights in Australia really do care for each other's welfare. I mean, it's not to say there's not a little bit of jealousy and stuff, for sure. Mm. You know, got that gig, I didn't, but that, I think that can be quite healthy in a way, because it spurs you on to go, damn it, I want that next time.
Yeah. So is there a production that you're most kind of proud of
working?
Yeah, I think last year's production, Normal, was my favourite. I mean, you hope that you get better with each one, of course, anyway, but that was quite a challenging show to pull off. You know, it was an independent production, so finances are always challenging. But I feel like together, so Anthony Skears directed, and he was just really so great to work with. And I had a really brilliant cast. And in spite of the financial challenges, I felt that as a team, they really helped me get the play to be, you know, the best that I could make it.
Which is, what is it about?
Oh, look, how you picked earlier, Regina, you're quite right. It was inspired by a true story. Well done, you. a group of teenage girls who all come down with this Tourette's-like illness. And there's like about 18 of them in the end in the real story. But so it's really examining that the idea of difference and fitting in, and the kind of viral nature of such things. And, you know, now we're in this situation where everyone's talking about viruses. I'm going like, oh, yes, there was something in the air.
Is this the one that's set in America and that you went over there working it for the Edward Albee?
That is where, yeah, that's where the original story happened. So it's not set there in my play. It's, it's, you know, an Australian sort of small town.
Yeah.
I got the Edward Albee playwriting scholarship for that. So I think that's part of why I feel proud of it, because it took a really long time to get the play produced, even though it had won awards and grants and all this stuff. Nobody would produce it. I think maybe because it was hard for them to sort of pigeonhole it, whether it was, you know, young people or adults or whatever. So I ended up going down the independent route. And in some ways it meant that we were able to do exactly what we wanted and do it the right way for the play. It was supposed to be on at the Canberra Youth Theatre. Luke Rogers was due to direct it there for a production in May, which has been cancelled. Well, hopefully just postponed. It was done in Melbourne at the end of last year by a high school down there, and Gavin Roach was going to produce it for Melbourne Fringe this year, and, of course, that's also been cancelled. That's why I'm proud of it, because it got to the point where the play was good enough that other people finally were able to kind of go, ah, I see now, and then, you know, want to pick it up themselves.
Yeah, some things do take time, don't they, to realise themselves. Why do you think, I mean, this is a terrible time for, like you say, it's cancelled, everything's cancelled, hopefully for future, but what do you think is important about this? Why do you think, you know, the schools down in Melbourne, or, you know, like, about the arts, like, what do you think it is that it does, theatre does, that nothing else does?
For me, I suppose it goes back to my initial impetus for doing theatre, the gathering of it. Theatre does what TV and film cannot do, although there's still the, you know, the exploring of stories, but it does that all in the, when everybody is in the same room together, breathing the same air, and because of that, agreeing to connect literally through our breath. I think there's something else that's really important, particularly at the moment, which is this idea, and again, yes, again, you've picked it, Regina, going back to the news, the thing is that theatre can be so political because it's really the best way for us to imagine a future world. Because we agree to be in the same space and we witness in front of us and in reality, because it's in the same space, difference, something that we haven't already seen. And I think it's so important at the moment, if you look at things like the Black Lives Matter movement, if we can't imagine a future that's different from our current reality, we can't act on it and we can't make it happen. And the same for, you know, representation of women in different roles on stage, or representation of differently abled people or people from diverse backgrounds. If we cannot imagine these different futures, how can we agitate for them and advocate for them? And yes, we, of course, film, TV, books, visual arts all do these things as well. But theatre is the only place that does it where the actor is embodying that in front of you and with your agreement and with your breath. So for me, it's that kind of absolutely enlivening, energising world of possibilities.
So what's the last thing that you've cut out and or captured and saved in a document from for inspiration?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Oh, wait, I do know. Yes, it's about terrorism and domestic violence.
Okay.
Yes.
Important things to bring up and to imagine a different future for as well.
So
how is your work? You work now at Currency Press as an editor. Is this influencing your work?
Well, what it does is it gives me access to so many brilliant works, of course, which is fantastic. It means I can work really closely with playwrights on their plays, which is such a joy. And as I said, I really genuinely feel like the playwriting community in this country is a brilliant and strong one. And it's such a privilege to be able to do things like call up Patricia Cornelius and say, "Hello, Patricia, I just have a question about this this thing here," or and have her talk to you. And I'm like, you know, it's a great education for me. And it's a real privilege to help bring those plays into the world.
It is fantastic. What advice would you give to anyone who wanted to, you know, pursue a career as a playwright?
Be resilient. Mm-hmm. Possibly can. Try and build that. I think I would also say if you're young, do it now. You know, go early and go hard, because mm-hmm. I started a bit late and that certainly doesn't help. And I would say find people who believe in you and hold on to them very tightly, and also believe in other people and be generous with your time with them, because, yeah, that support for each other is what will see us all through, and hopefully then we grow the space for each other.
Absolutely. Oh, Katie Polly, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Regina. It's been delightful talking to you. I appreciate it.
And that was Katie Pollock, playwright and editor for Currency Press. Stick around. Trisha Stiles will be up soon to give us a little insight into some things you can catch. And over to you, Trisha Stars.
Hi, Regina. Let's talk what's on in Sydney. Short message service is a moment of theatre delivered to you to your phone in the comfort of your own home, which is great in lockdown, isn't it? It's developed and programmed by Q Theatre. This special moment of theatre will be delivered to audiences via a series of 10 text messages over 1 hour and crafted by playwrights including Western Sydney's locals Donna Abella, Monica Elia and Margaret Davis, and acclaimed writer and satirist Jonathan Biggins, and winner of the Indigenous Playwrights Award, Katie Beckett. Now, the first short message service will feature an original work by Blue Mountains playwright Margaret Davis, and it kicks off on Friday the 31st of July between the hours of 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. And then on Friday the 7th of August at the same time, Donna Abella, Friday the 14th of August, Monica Elia, Friday the 28th of August, Jonathan Biggins, and Friday the 4th of September, Katie Beckett. Audiences can register online to experience the free and exclusive short message service program, and they just need to provide a mobile phone number. So just go to www.qtheatre.com.au. The next bit of news is Jack Charles versus The Crown. And you can get onto this through the Joan Sutherland Performing Arts Centre, or you can go directly to www.artscentremelbourne.com.au and just look for Jack Charles versus The Crown. It's on demand until the 24th of July. It's an extraordinary tale told by one of Australia's living treasures, Uncle Jack Charles, based on his life and spoken in his own words. And this is part of Melbourne's NAIDOC Week 2020 digital program. So don't miss Jack Charles versus The Crown. In other news, just Google Gecko Theatre. Their latest screening is Institute, and it is amazing. Also on Gecko Theatre, you can see a lot of their past films and plays. Now, another one to Google is Druid Theatre. They have a fantastic online program, and you can watch wonderful plays such as The Well of the Saints, The Shadow of the Glen, Riders to the Sea, and The Playboy of the Western World, one of my favourites. And that's all through their website, but you get onto their Vimeo account and you can watch all of those plays. It's absolutely wonderful. The Public Theatre is producing a radio drama of Richard II, and this is dedicated to the Black Lives Matter movement, and it's directed by the wonderful Saheem Ali. Now, this is brought to you in a serialised radio broadcast over 4 nights. So don't miss this, and you can listen to this from anywhere in the world because it's at podcasts.apple.com, and then look for Free Shakespeare on the Radio, Richard II. So that's all the news we have for this week. There's so much online theatre and more is coming. So get onto your computers, and if you can't go out to the theatre, watch it online. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Tricia. You've been listening to Stages. I'm Regina Botros, and a big thanks to Katie Pollock for joining us earlier on in the show. Stick around for Film Fight Club. We'll be back next week with more theatre. I'll leave you with Idiot Prayer from Nick Cave's live performance tomorrow evening online. Also, if you're a bit of a Nick Cave fan and do covers, you can send in your Nick Cave cover, film it, and send it by the 31st of July, and he will play it on his Bad Seeds TV. So that's TWVEE.
Once there was a song, the song yearned to be sung. It was a spinning song about the king of rock and roll. And the king was first a young prince. The prince was the best, with his black jelly hair. He crashed onto a stage in Vegas. And the king had a queen. The queen's hair was a stairway. She tended the castle garden, and in the garden planted a tree. And the garden tree was a stairway. It was 15 branches high. On the top branch was a nest. Sing the high, cloudy nest. In the nest there was a bird. The bird had a wing. The wing had a feather. Spin the feather and sing the wind. The king in time died. The queen's heart broke like a vow. And the tree returned to the earth with the nest and the bird. But the feather spun upwards, upwards and upwards, spinning all the weather vanes, spinning up over the streets, spinning up over the crowds, spinning up over the cities, forever spinning. Well, this prayer is for you, my love, sent on the wings of a dove, upward and upward and up.